Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Hello. From the studios of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Byron Scott, your host for this week's discussion of world news events by professionals whose job it is to report the facts and analyze the consequences. In an Alphonse and Gaston routine worthy of those early 20th century cartoon characters, Russia's President Medvedev and former president, now Prime Minister Putin, recently declared their intentions to run for each other's office in the March 2012 national elections, and in doing so, avoid their nation's constitutional ban against three consecutive terms. In effect, this means that Vladimir Putin will continue to run Russia, as many feel he has done under Dmitry Medvedev anyway, for at least 12 more years. What does this after you maneuver mean for the future of the Russian economy, public institutions, international relations, and freedom of the press? All in a potentially declining and dangerous state. Here to discuss the situation are Luke Harding, an award-winning international correspondent for The Guardian, speaking to us from London, Galina Sidorova, co-founder of Russia's Foundation for Investigative Journalism and vice chair of the International Press Institute Executive Board, who is calling in from Moscow, and also joining us from Moscow, Maria Lippmann, who is editor-in-chief of Pro et Contra at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Moscow Center. Luke, it's a well-founded journalistic practice that on occasions such as this, you lead with a good story. In February of this year, you became the first Western journalist since the end of the Cold War to be expelled from Russia, after years as Guardian's Moscow correspondent. What did you do to deserve that?
That's a great question. I'm still asking myself this, and I'm afraid I don't have a definitive answer. But I think my problems in Russia went on for about 4 years, essentially at their heart was the FSB, Russia's Federal Security Service, which is the successor agency to the KGB. And I think essentially the FSB constructed some kind of fantasy in which I played the role of James Bond. Now, I don't look like James Bond. I've got kind of rather rubbish clothes and, you know, I don't drink martini and I don't even own a car. But they were convinced that I was some kind of spy or foreign agent, and they treated me accordingly. They sort of broke repeatedly into the Moscow flat where I live with my wife and our two small children. They didn't steal anything, but they did these kind of demonstrative burglaries where they moved our stuff around and opened the window of my son's bedroom when we lived on the 10th floor, that they summoned me for an interview in Lefortovo, which is the KGB's notorious prison in Moscow. And they basically gave me a hard time. And this culminated, as you say, with Russia's foreign ministry in November of last year summoning me to this kind of Cold War-style interview, telling me my accreditation would not be renewed. And then, following the intervention of the British government, my accreditation was renewed for 6 months, but when I flew back in February of this year, I was stopped at passport control at Moscow airport and told by a young official that for me, Russia was closed, and I was taken to a cell, locked in, and then bundled back on the next plane. And that, in brief, is my story.
That, in brief, is your story. And let's get the reaction of Galina and Masha. Galina Sidorova, this was unusual for Russia, at least in the post-Cold War era. What happened? What does this say to those of us watching Russia today?
Myself is probably not the person to ask about this because I don't know what happened. I can only guess.
Sure.
I think that you were right to mention that such a practice was in full swing in the years of Cold War. The practice that journalists often became kind of scapegoats of the wars between their different surveillance or
right.
intelligence services. Kind of, they became the scapegoats of the games among them, between them.
Right.
So I don't know whether it is the same thing or not. The only thing I can proceed with this, I would like just to add that not only our friend and our colleague Luke and probably some other foreign correspondents experienced some kind of bad stuff in recent years, but only also Russian journalists,
So talk a little about the situation of Russian journalists now, Galina.
Unfortunately, what we saw in the recent years was the firm or the grip of the officials, the grip of official bureaucracy, and also the intelligence and other law enforcement institutions, as we say, became tougher over the press. And it's we can see that more and more journalists also in the Federal Center in Moscow, like Moscow and St. Petersburg, but also in the regions, they face really problems in fulfilling their work. Some there were beginning with the year 2001, there were 39 cases of murder of journalists at work, and that is really a very big
39.
Figure. And only in this year, we had already two cases like this. So my Foundation for Investigative Journalism, we monitor these cases. We try to be in the know of what is going on in Russia, I mean all over Russia, and two cases in the regions already from the, this year. So we experienced problems, my colleagues experienced problems, especially those who work in the investigative journalism, doing investigative journalism. We experienced pressure on behalf of officials, on behalf of criminal structures. So this is really not the best time for us.
Yes. And I know that Russian journalists, being what they are, will survive. Maria Lippmann, 12 more years of Putin. It's a very strange chant. What does this mean not only for journalists the kinds of things that you study at the Moscow Center?
Well, Putin's return, or actually, in fact, he never disappeared, and he played right. this trick of stepping down, technically speaking, in 2008, but in fact stayed on as by far the most influential and the most powerful politician in the country. So in a way, we can be talking about not his comeback, but the continuation.
Yeah, he was never gone.
If you like, his fourth and fifth term as the Russian, as Russia's top leader. I would say this means more of the same political system, and the political system that Putin created, that he built during his tenure, his first 8 years in power, is the system of political monopoly. It is a system in which all sources of power except the top executive have been radically emasculated, in which political competition had been gotten rid of, in which checks and balances were radically weakened. For the Russian media, this means that whatever media can produce in terms of even investigative reporting, we have some, falls flat and remains irrelevant. For media to be effective in any society, it takes competitive politics. It takes political opposition that picks an issue raised by the media and turns it from political news into political events. What we do not have in Russia is this mechanism. In fact, there is quite a lot of exposure of wrongdoings of Russian officials. There are stories exposing corruption. There are stories exposing abuse, very hard abuse of office by the police. And the list of such publications can be very long. However, all these publications remain irrelevant and can easily be ignored by a government that enjoys a political monopoly.
And are there no valid opponents to United Russia?
United Russia
parties?
Not only has a majority in the state legislature, in the state Duma, it is not just that. It is that the Kremlin, vis-a-vis political parties in Russia, has assumed a posture of, if you like, a sculptor, which can mold political parties, can then merge different party projects, as they come to be called in Russia, can scrap those that are no longer needed, can come up with new ones ad lib. Any moment that they need a new party, they just simply shape it and put it in the field. The Kremlin controls the political field in a sense that the entry to the political field is closed to all that are not welcome, the Kremlin does not want to play politics. And the Kremlin has been very successful and very effective in controlling the political field.
Mm. You know what? Yes, go ahead, Galina.
Uh-huh. The worst thing, it seems, there is one very bad thing about the situation. What Putin did, or his people did, during this 8 year, or this year's beginning from the 2000, the year of 2000, they ruined all, you know, this normal political democratic system, building this vertical of power. They, we don't have any, you know, young politicians coming normally through the local elections, being, as it were, trained to politics. We don't have normal local elections. So we don't have any new faces, any new personalities on our political scale, independent, who can really achieve something, who can be trained as politicians in their normal, you know, in a normal way through normal democratic institutions.
Right. Galina, let me come back to you in just a moment here. At this point, I'm constrained to say that before we continue this discussion, I want to remind our audience that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. And you'll also be interested in the articles, interviews, and other features that are part of the website. You also can send us questions or comments, care of Global Journalist Program at gmail.com, or simply look us up on Facebook. A lot of communication possibilities. Galina, back to you. I was sorry to interrupt.
So that's what I wanted to say, that that's why we don't have all these so-called party projects and new parties. They're usually party projects with the old guys. I mean, not old by age, but all those guys who already participated in the political process in the 90s. We don't have any new perspective political figures who could be political opposition to our present leaders in the, let's say, in the, this year or some years from now. That's really a problem. I mean,
indeed.
A big problem.
Go ahead, Luke.
Yeah, add to what Galina was saying. I mean, I think if we just step back and look at this Putin system, I mean, some people say, I think rather plausibly, that actually Putin kind of doesn't really want to come back for a third, or as Masha says, a fourth term as president, that he's tired, he'd like to go and relax in Sochi on the Black Sea coast and so on. But the problem is the logic of the system is that essentially it's not about ideology anymore as it was in Soviet times. There's no overriding project for Putin and his team beyond hanging onto their assets. Now, you just have to look at Forbes magazine to see that many of Putin's friends are now billionaires, or indeed stroll around the streets of West London and Belgravia and see that most of the houses there are, or many of the houses are owned by extremely wealthy Russians whose mm-hmm. sources of income can only be guessed at. And the problem for Putin is that were he to step down, he would face the prospect potentially from any successor of law enforcement prosecutions of not only being, you know, deprived of office, but possibly being thrown in jail as well. And so Putin is the only person who can kind of glue this kind of fantastically corrupt system together. And we know from WikiLeaks, we know from what U.S. diplomats have been writing privately back to the U.S. State Department that, and I write this in my book, which has just come out, that essentially Russia is a mafia state these days. It's not about ideology. It's just about money and revenues and keeping that going. And I think this is a really kind of despairing moment for anyone inside Russia or out of Russia who cares about democracy and who just wants a kind of really a kind of more decent Russia. I mean, it doesn't even have to be perfect. It just has to be more progressive, more human, and more tolerant than the version we've got at the moment. And having spoken to friends in Moscow, they are in despair at the prospect of Putin going on and on and on, yes. Out, you know, clocking up more years than Leonid Brezhnev, who managed 18, and you know, as things look, catching up on Comrade Stalin, who did 31.
All right, let me interrupt you there, by the way, with a compliment, mm-hmm. Luke. You got the name of your new book in there very smoothly, and our viewers, by the way, as you were doing that, we're seeing the cover on their screen. So
thank you.
So I appreciate that. I want to find out what Galina and Masha feel about this. And of course, the logical question, although it might be simplistic, is why do ordinary Russians seem to be comfortable with all this?
If I may, there's one remark to begin with.
Go ahead, Maria.
Putin ruined the democratic system in Russia. Truth is, we didn't have a democratic system. We had a promise of it under President Yeltsin, but that system did not take root, and that system did not come to be appreciated by the people, and competitive politics did not come to be seen by the Russian people at large as a way to make their lives better. Voting out the incumbent, voting in somebody else who is more to people's taste, hoping that this new government will be better than the previous one. This kind of mechanism, this kind of democratic competitive politics, as it is known in many countries in Europe and many countries in the West, has not taken root, has not been appreciated, and the current mindset in Russia, the dominant mindset in Russia, is that yes, there are lots and lots of problems. Civil servants are corrupt. They are self-seeking. They enrich themselves at people's expense. People are anything but stupid or naive. They see the problems. They see the corruption. They see the disparity of income. They see that the police have become a force, not a force for protection, but a threat to the people. To any of these questions, you get a majority of answers in public opinion polls that indicate that people see the system for what it is. However, people prefer to vote for the status quo, expecting that any change is bound to make things worse, not better. And this is one way to answer your question as to why this is tolerated. The system, the state-society relations in Russia today can be described as, if you like, a peaceful divorce or a non-participation pact. The government tells people not to meddle with politics, and people accept this and actually sigh with relief not to have to share the responsibility for national development. In exchange, the government delivers, and it doesn't meddle with people's individual pursuits. This is what makes today's Russia radically different from Brezhnev's Russia, as I remember it as a person from an older generation. Quite a few of the constraints that made life so stifling under Brezhnev do not exist today. Individual pursuit is generally free as long as it does not border on politics. And these two parallel worlds, the world of individual pursuits and the world of state affairs coexist, keeping life for people tolerable as long as the government delivers and as long as the government meets its part of the pact and does not meddle in individual pursuits, be it drawing profit, fulfilling yourself in academic activities or art or culture.
Let me, Galina, I know you want to comment on this.
Yeah.
Let me also ask you to comment on how the Anna Politkovskaya case, which is now 5 years old, and she is one of those 39 dead journalists, assassinated journalists you mentioned.
Yes, absolutely. Just one remark before I switch to Anna's case. Putin seems to be, at the moment, the one and only oligarch in Russia. We had a couple of oligarchs, many, or probably dozens of oligarchs in the 90s. And at the moment, Putin is one and only, because all the main resources, I mean, everything is accumulated by Putin and his team, Putin and the businessmen who are closely connected with Putin and his, his friends and et cetera, et cetera. That is kind of the top of this corruption pyramid. And the very bad thing is that, as I agree 100% with what Masha said on this corruption thing, because people are ready. This is a systemic corruption, so people see that it is corruption. People read in the newspapers or see on the net that all these exposures of the these policemen or that and et cetera, et cetera. They did so and so. So they read all these stories. But on the other hand, they feel themselves as a part of part of all of this. They go to a certain office, bureaucratic office, to get some kind of a paper for their house, for instance. And they know that they had to pay some extra money to get this document quickly. Otherwise, they can wait for ages.
Right.
So this kind of, everybody becomes kind of part of this corruption system.
Part of the system.
We're
running out of time here.
And just about Anna, that there were certain developments in the case recently. They brought a couple of people, they forwarded new accusations. One of the personalities is Mr. Pavlyuchenko, who used to be a senior police officer and used to be a witness in the, in the first hearings. He used to be a witness. Now he is an accused. And I think he had this kind of deal with the, with the prosecutor, because he admitted that he was the one who organized the surveillance of Anna, because he was a police officer at that time and he had all these resources to do this. But the worst thing is, although we have two or three new names, although not new, but names new as an accused, but still I'm sure, and my colleagues here are sure, that the main organizers of the killing are not named. And we really do not believe that it will happen in the near future. Although
some new people
can be, probably even be convicted.
Right.
That's the key point, that with all of these murders of human rights defenders, journalists, sort of civil society figures, that mm-hmm. we don't know who's behind them, and there's no political appetite to find out who is responsible, because the suspicion, I mean, obviously we can't prove this, is the trail loops back towards the Kremlin or to people in official positions, especially when there's a Chechen connection. I mean, you mentioned Anna Politkovskaya, but also, of course, similarly, there's Natalia Estimirova, who was a fantastically brave human rights activist,
mm-hmm.
Who was abducted and executed in Grozny 2 summers ago. And similarly, there's been no progress on her case either. And I think the dismaying thing, to go back to Putin again, is that with Putin in power, no prospect of de-Putinization, if you like, taking place, that we're just not going to know the truth about these murders. I mean, another similar case, there's a 50-year anniversary coming up of the murder in London of Alexander Litvinenko, who was a kind of FSB guy turned dissident, murdered with polonium in a month after Anna Politkovskaya in 2006. And I've been talking to his widow, Marina, and she's kind of despairing about ever really getting any kind of justice, because the people who are allegedly responsible are essentially being protected by the Russian state.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to interrupt here and bring this discussion to a close. I'm sure we'll be talking to all three of you again soon as these stories about Russian society continue to develop. I want to thank our guests, Maria Lippmann and Guina Sidorova from Moscow, and from London, Luke Harding. Our director is Joe Deutschman. Audio by Pat Akers. Our executive producer is Raman Tungekar. The lead producer for the show is Jessica Popovac, assisted by David Cawthon and Ryan Kress. This is my final show as the regular host for Global Journalist. Although I'll continue to substitute on occasion, the host beginning next week will be David Reed, formerly a senior news editor at RFERL in Prague and AP correspondent. I'm sure you'll enjoy his interviews with our remarkable guests. This has been a very enjoyable experience for me, and I'm also looking forward not only to sitting in, but to continuing to make contributions to the globaljournalist.org website and to contribute occasional commentaries on my own travels abroad. We hope you'll continue to enjoy them. Don't forget our website, globaljournalist.org. And I wish you good night and good luck, as someone once said. And now, stay tuned. Free Press Watch comes along next. This is Byron Scott for Global Journalist.
And now, Global Journalist Free Press Watch, where each week we bring you a roundup of major events in press freedom from around the world. I'm Jessica Popovac. A Burmese blogger has been released just 3 years into his 59-year prison sentence. His release is part of a promised amnesty for more than 6,000 prisoners as the country makes its tenuous transition from military to civilian rule. As of this taping, 13 other journalists remain behind bars, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, and several laws limiting freedom of the press remained on the books. And in Pakistan, the web editor of the country's edition of the London Post was found dead in his apartment after receiving multiple threats. Faisal Qureshi recently wrote a story about the leader of the MQM, a liberal secular political party. Police say his body showed signs of torture and his phone and laptop were missing. Qureshi was 28 years old. As always, you can find links to these and other stories on our website at www.globaljournalist.org. On behalf of everyone here at Global Journalist Radio, thank you for joining us.